to the Sex Talk Cafe, a podcast where you'll get to learn from the experts in the field of sex, love, and relationships. The mission of the Sex Talk Cafe is to normalize the conversation on sexuality while building a bridge between the sexual and spiritual. I'm your host, Susan Morgan Taylor. I'm a holistic sex therapist, intuitive coach, and specialist in women's sexuality and feminine spirituality. I'm the founder and CEO of the Pathway to Pleasure Collective, where I help women and couples around the world restore intimacy, save their relationship, and get back to love without feeling like they have to sacrifice themselves just to keep their partner happy. Thank you so much for joining me. Welcome to the Sex Talk Cafe. Well, hello, hello, and welcome everybody to the Sex Talk Cafe. And I am very excited about our topic for today's conversation. And what I would like to say before we dive in, that I just want to give a heads up that for some of you listening, this could be a triggering topic. You may have certain ideas about today's topic, one way or the other. And I would just invite you to have an open mind today. Our topic is going to be about circumcision, specifically male genital circumcision. And we're going to touch base on many other areas around that as well, including female circumcision and really just the whole topic altogether, which is really a topic that I'm really interested in and very passionate about. So I just want to invite our listeners just to come in today with an open mind, see what you can learn, and maybe see if you can leave here with perhaps a little bit of a different perspective on this cultural phenomenon that we have here in the United States mostly. That is my invitation to you, is just to come with an open mind and see what you can learn. I'm very excited about today's guests. We have Tim Hammond, who is the founder and president of the Genital Autonomy Legal Defense and Education Fund. And in 1989, Tim Hammond co-founded the National Organization of Restoring Men, which is now an international group to provide moral and technical support to circumcised men seeking foreskin restoration. That's a fascinating topic that I'm looking forward to diving into today. He followed that in 1992 by founding the National Organization to Halt the Abuse and Routine Mutilation of Males, a direct action protest group to give circumcision sufferers a public voice. In 1995, Tim produced the world's first feature-length documentary to challenge circumcision. The award-winning film, Whose Body, Whose Rights, was broadcast on various PBS stations across the United States. From 1999 to 2023, he published three large-scale surveys documenting the long-term physical, sexual, emotional, and psychological consequences of newborn circumcision, and has presented his work at many international health and human rights conferences. In 2022, Tim founded the Genital Autonomy Legal Defense and Education Fund, whose mission is to support legal professionals and bringing impact litigation to ensure equal protection of bodily integrity of boys at risk of medically unnecessary penile circumcision. Very excited to welcome Tim Hammond to the Sex Talk Cafe. Tim, welcome.
Thank you very much, Susan. It's my pleasure to be here.
Yeah, I'm really excited about our conversation today, and I think it would be really helpful for our listeners, maybe just to first begin with GALDEF, the Genital Autonomy Legal Defense and Education Fund. And let's just kind of touch really in on what is the mission of this organization.
Sure, I'd be happy to. As background, I've been involved in this issue for 35 plus years. And like anybody who first starts to get involved in this, they kind of naively think, oh, well, all you have to do is explain that the foreskin has functions and it's painful and it's harmful, and people will suddenly drop the habit and the custom. Well, that doesn't necessarily work with all people. And there's also the medical profession to deal with. This is an ingrained practice in the U.S. medical profession, not very prevalent elsewhere in the world. There are financial incentives behind it and so forth to keep this practice alive. So at this point in my life, I've really gotten a bit frustrated, and in typical American fashion, one possible solution will be to take this to the courts and get them to look at the law and make the decision about whether we need to be protecting all children from medically unnecessary genital cutting, or if we're okay just having a law, as we do now, that just protects those who are born with a vulva. It does not protect those born, not protect those children who are born intersex. So we don't have equal protection under the law, and it is my hope with our really fantastic board of directors that we work with attorneys, educate them on how we argue these cases, and hopefully create impact litigation that changes the legal landscape in the U.S. to a wider awareness that all children need to be protected.
Yeah, so a couple of things come to mind here. Just for our listeners, many states, or if not all, there might be, I'm not sure, maybe you can answer this, but there is a lot of legislation already around preventing female genital mutilation or female circumcision practices in almost all states, I believe. Is that correct?
Well, it's in about half the states right now.
Okay.
Plus, we have a federal statute. But it's interesting, the language across different states define female genital cutting differently. In many of the states, they say it's illegal to remove the female foreskin, which is commonly called the clitoral hood. And yet, we're removing the male foreskin, the penile foreskin, which actually is a much larger structure. It accommodates or constitutes about 50% of the shaft skin of the penis. So it's a much larger amount of tissue than the clitoral hood or the female prepuce. And those laws prohibit that. And they prohibit even lesser forms like nicking and pricking. And yet it's still technically legal to do more invasive surgery that isn't medically necessary on a newborn's penis.
Yeah. And so part of your movement is to for equal protection so that there are laws in place to protect baby boys, just like there are for little baby girls and women.
That would be our hope, because actually, when it comes right down to it, these laws on female genital mutilation, 99.99% of females are not at risk in the U.S. of this. Yet in the U.S., we have a circumcision rate nationally of about 50%, and that's like 1.25 million babies a year. So there's an imbalance there in the way we look at the rights of children.
Absolutely. Yeah, and just also for our listeners, the term impact litigation, can you describe what that means when you refer to impact litigation?
Yeah, impact litigation means bold, courageous litigation that really changes the way the legal system views something. Past examples might be the Civil Rights Act of 1964, in which we looked at race and sex differently under the law. Same-sex marriage, marriage equality, was impact litigation at Galba in regards to genital cutting of children.
I think it's really unique what you're doing as well in terms of this angle of actually getting going into the legal justice system. And I think it would be really useful for us to maybe talk a little bit about why is that? Why do you think that's important? Why is taking this into the courts and actually getting litigation, hopefully successful outcomes in the court system? Why is that important to this, the mission of GALDEF and just sort of the cause of stopping male infant circumcision in general?
Sure. Well, obviously the best course of action when you have any kind of ingrained social custom is education. But as we've learned over the decades, these deep customs, and the same thing with female circumcision in Africa and the Middle East, these are deeply held emotional issues, which don't always respond well to logical reasoning. And there are limits to what that can accomplish. And when you are looking at social change, when you look at the history of social change in the U.S., it has always been advanced by bringing litigation to the courts to get the courts to look dispassionately at the law to say, do we have a problem here and how do we fix this? Because, of course, another route to take would be legislation But as we recently learned in the state of New Hampshire, in which children's rights advocates tried to get better informed consent regulations in place around newborn male circumcision and to end Medicaid funding of infant circumcision, politicians, you know, they're people. They have their own biases. They have their own cultural upbringing. They have their own denial about maybe what's been done to them or what they've allowed to be done to their children. And so there's certain resistance in the legislative arena, which is why the ultimate arbiter of equality would be the courts, as has been proven time and time again with other groups of people based on race or sex, sexual orientation, and so forth.
Yeah. Well, and what about, you know, this topic of circumcision, like I said at the outset, tends to really be triggering. And I think that there's a lot of people listening to this right now going, what is the big deal? It's not, you know, it's not harmful. It's cleaner. We've been doing it forever. Most people don't have a problem. What's the big deal with circumcision? So why don't we dive into that topic and have a little chat about this whole thing called circumcision, which has been referred to as a solution looking for a cure. I believe that was in your documentary, also in American Circumcision, Brendan Morata's documentary. It's a solution looking for a cure. So let's talk about this. What is going on?
The actual quote comes from Edward Wallerstein in his 1980 book, Circumcision, an American Health Fallacy. And the actual quote was, circumcision is a solution in search of a problem. And
oh, I said it wrong.
That's it's okay. It's, you know,
a solution looking for a problem. I wrote it down
wrong. It's a solution in search of a problem is really what circumcision is. And what I like to say is that all of these ideas about it's cleaner, it's not harmful, it's extra skin that doesn't matter, this is all what I call myth information.
Yeah.
Now, I do not have a lisp, but it is myth information.
I like that.
Based on the idea that, I mean, number one, it's cleaner. Yes, any part of your body would be cleaner if you cut it off. I mean, we could apply that same rationale to the female genitalia, right? It's harmless. Well, it's interesting that the American Academy of Pediatrics, in its policies on circumcision in 1989 and 2012, both admitted, although they said the benefits outweigh the risks, they admitted in writing, we don't know what the long-term harm is because it's really never been studied. And that's where I kind of done my surveys of large-scale surveys of men who suffer from circumcision is to find out why, you know, emotional, sexual, psychological, that thing. And so we don't really know the long-term adverse outcomes because it's never really truly been studied. And yes, you don't hear a lot of men complaining about circumcision. Although, if you go back into the media literature, this topic has been covered since the 1980s of men seeking foreskin restoration and why have they been motivated to do that.
Right.
The scientific literature over the past 10 or 15 years has really proven that the foreskin, or the prepuce is the medical term, it constitutes about 50% of the shaft skin of the penis. It's a double fold of skin. The outer fold is like dermal, regular dermal tissue. The inner fold is mucosal tissue.
Mm-hmm.
And it's densely innervated. Estimates are 10 to 20,000 nerve endings.
Wow.
Meissner's corpus, like we have in our fingertips and our lips and other parts of our body. And it's a primary sensory organ of the penis, not the head of the penis.
Right.
In fact, one researcher has called the glands, the head of the penis, a dumb organ compared to the foreskin.
Yeah.
The foreskin is a mobile gliding sheath. It contributes to sexual pleasure, lubrication. It has immunological functions. And of course, the primary protective function of the head of the penis, just as the female foreskin, the clitoral hood, protects the clitoris.
Yeah. Well, and I think that's something that most people don't realize. And I think in your documentary, it said the foreskin, like on infant, it's kind of different because they're so small. But once an infant develops into a grown man, that foreskin, as you said, compromises about 50% of the skin of the penis. And I think you gave the visual of 15 quarters. That's a size of skin that you could line up 15 quarters. That's a lot. I mean, that was really impactful when I was watching that, of like, wow, I mean, I don't think that that really lands for most people. That's a lot of tissue to remove, even though I know they're doing it on infants and it's not as much at that point, but on a fully developed penis, that's a lot of surface area to get rid of.
And we like to call it a little snip, but anything you cut off of a baby is a little snip.
Yeah.
And what doctors are doing is basically performing microsurgery. They're working on a sex organ about the size of your fingertip. And what happens as the person with the penis matures is that that double layer of tissue, when you cut it off, Dr. John Taylor, Canadian physician, did some research on cadavers. And when you cut off the adult foreskin and then open it up to lie flat, the outer and inner layers of the foreskin, you have about a 3x5 index card.
Wow.
Inside an area. And that's about 15 square inches. And if you place a bunch of quarters on it, you have the number of quarters there that were in the video, Whose Body, Whose Rights, and each area the size of a quarter is loaded with nerve endings and blood vessels and Dartos fascia muscle, and it's an incredibly unique part of your body. The only thing that comes close to that is your eyelid, but it's the most densely nerve-laden part of a man's body.
Yeah. And we're removing this from boys when they're infants, tiny babies.
At a time when they can't consent, and you don't have any idea how that boy is going to grow up and come to view his body.
Right.
In our culture, just as in cultures that circumcise females, they grow up thinking, oh, this is normal. This was an enhancement. I look better. I'm cleaner, blah, blah, blah. But then when you really begin to delve into it, and you look at the reasons why it was initially adopted in this country, and other issues, the functions of the foreskin, the anatomy, you begin to shift your attitude. And that's where many men go, and many circumcised women go from, oh, this is good, this was something done for me, it's an enhancement. They shift to the other side and say, wow, this was something done to me.
Yeah.
This was not a good thing. Even though my parents loved me, thinking they were doing the best thing, it's not about making people feel guilty, but still the effect is it shifts their attitude from thinking of it and as an enhancement to a mutilation.
Right.
And that's a very personal word to use. I never point my finger and say, well, you're mutilated. That's something for each of us who've had this done to us, male or female, to come to that conclusion.
Yeah, like sort of realizing what you're missing that you can never get back.
Yeah, I think the way I was thinking about this morning, remember the movie The Wizard of Oz, when Dorothy is in Kansas and the tornado picks up her house and plops her down in Munchkin Land, and then everything up to that point is in black and white. And she opens the door, and everything to me is like the difference between circumcised and intact, which we all. So you get to the point of realizing sex with a circumcised penis is like experiencing life in black and white, when you could have experienced everything in full color.
Right.
Another analogy that people have used is it's like listening to an orchestra without the string section. You're not getting full experience.
And I mean, I think a lot of people would respond, a lot of men might respond to, well, I don't notice any difference. It all feels great to me. Like, why is this a problem? I've heard that response, and I'm kind of curious, like, what your take is on that. I have my theories on it, but you know, like, this, why is this a big deal? I don't, sex feels great. I don't see what the big problem is. Like, get over it kind of thing.
That's fine. That's their attitude. That is not an excuse, though, for allowing it to continue to future generations.
Sure. I mean, I agree.
If I'm speaking to a prospective father, I would say, well, sure, you think sex is great with a circumcised penis, but your son is going to be born with everything you had, and it was taken from you. Wouldn't you want your son to experience something better, perhaps, than what you've been able to experience? You'll
Yeah.
never know because it was cut off before you got to experience it. But I will tell you, men can sort of approximate the experience of what it would be like to have a foreskin if you run your finger over the back of your hand. It feels one way. You turn your palm over and run your finger on the inside of the palm, it's a much finer sensory experience. That would be the experience that you have with the foreskin, is to be able to have a greater ability, a sensory ability that is more than what you have now as a circumcised person.
Well, I feel like there's a real resistance even to wanting to admit that even that much what you just said, because you know, to admit that something's missing would be, you know, possibly could possibly open up a can of worms that I think a lot of people would rather not deal with. They'd rather not face that or have to feel reality of that. So it's easier to just be in denial of it. And if we have this sort of cultural denial that anything's a problem, you know, by the generations that are doing this to the little boys, to me it seems like it's a challenging thing to, you know, shift that mindset. As I know, you know, I mean, you said that at the outset of our conversation here, that you think it's going to be an easy thing, a little bit of education and like everyone should see what's really going on here, but it just isn't like that. There's such an ingrained mythology and an ingrained brainwashing around this practice. So it just seems like there's a lot of the myth information, like what you mentioned. It's really hard to undo that.
It is because it's been said, what man wants to admit that he's lost the best part of his penis, the only movable part, the one that was most highly sensory innervated. It takes a great deal of strength of character to admit that. And I do know that if you go on Reddit, there are circumcision grief Reddits. Lot of men on there. Men deal differently with these issues than women do, I think. A lot of men don't want to deal in person, so they deal, and there really aren't much in the way of any resources for men on this topic yet. There is some beginnings of this in the UK, but not so much here in the US. But when you go on to these internet forums, you hear devastating stories of how this awareness has affected these people, even to the point with some men, and this has been unstudied largely, is suicide. When you don't really know what you can do, there's nobody out there to help you. Everybody puts you down. There's no place to really talk or get any help. And some men do commit suicide. And I wouldn't necessarily limit this to men, teenagers also. Have been known to commit suicide over this, because it's a hard awakening
Yeah,
that
very difficult. And I think in particular when you don't have support or you have outright invalidation, even by professionals who you would think and should be equipped to at least be at the very minimum become curious about somebody's experience around that. However, some of the reports I've received is just flat outright invalidation by, say, a mental health professional that somebody reached out to and completely was invalidated. Well, everyone gets that done. What's the big deal? Get over it. I mean, so that kind of stuff really, it causes real harm. I think doctors as well, I'm sure there's been experiences like that. So you have someone who's obviously struggling with something that is very much, it's psychological, it's emotional, it's sexual, all these pieces of our being that are wrapped up in that. And yet there's no really place for that voice to come out. Like it might be called like a hidden grief or a forbidden grief in a way, similar to like women who have abortions, for example, because that's so taboo. There's very few spaces as well, for women to really speak about their grief. And I feel like there's a real similarity with men that are struggling with the circumcision trauma that they're, or the circ it's loss. I think it's trauma to the body, something that happens when they're an infant, which the body remembers, but also there's this piece of loss. And we know the stages of grief and loss, in depression, denial, anger, bargaining, all those things I think are stages that men who struggle with this go through. And unfortunately, like you said, that depression can really take hold. And if there's no outlet for it, it's really sad to me that that could end in suicide. And I know there was one advocate for this cause. I think he was a Canadian man who took his own life not that long ago. I can't remember his name, but he was an advocate for this issue and speaking out and was in some documentaries.
Well, there have been a couple. Jonathan Comte was a Bay Area intactivist in San
Oh, that might
Francisco.
be who I'm thinking of. Yeah, Bay Area. Okay.
Took his life over this. But there was a Canadian, a young man, Canadian. He's actually British, but he moved to Canada. He got circumcised later in life and was not given adequate information about this. And it totally ruined his sexuality and his self-esteem and so forth. And he ended up taking his life, and he left a letter explaining this. There's an excellent book about his life. It's called A is for Alex, and it was written by his mother
Oh.
about she never wants to see any boy being subjected to genital cutting without, a valid medical reason.
Right.
But those are so rare. These medical reasons. We're living in the 21st century, and we're still practicing a Bronze Age ritual. There are, and I just want to make this point clear, for any alleged benefit that circumcision is claimed to offer, there are non-surgical alternatives.
Yeah.
For example, little girls get UTIs at higher rates than boys do. How do we treat little girls? We don't cut parts of their genitalia off. We give them antibiotics.
Yep.
Penile cancer, cervical cancer, these are mostly caused by human papillomavirus. We now have vaccines available for that. And I know vaccines are a controversial
Yeah.
subject.
Yeah, it's
Still,
another can of worms.
we can offer that. Hygiene. Well, we have running water and we teach little girls how to keep their genitals clean. We can teach
Right.
little boys. There's just all kinds of non-surgical alternatives to give
Right.
the
Well,
alleged benefit.
STDs, the STDs would be another one. That's another defense that I hear.
STD. You
Right.
teach your children about, depending on your particular point of view, abstinence, monogamy. If you're going to have sex, use condoms. Practice good hygiene before and after sex. Most of the world's men, by the way, are intact. 75% of the world's men are not circumcised, and they're not dropping like flies because of
Right.
disease.
Yeah, I think the penile cancer piece from my research on that, and tell me if this is what you've discovered as well, is I think there is some support that having a foreskin might be a factor. However, what they found, usually that's in like indigent people who are not clean, or there's been lack of proper care of the penis and foreskin that could be a contributing factor. And it typically happens like very old Man, like way later in life. This isn't like something that is afflicting 7-year-olds, you know, or
That's right.
right.
That's right. Why are you circumcising a baby to prevent them from a sexually transmitted disease? I mean, it
Right.
makes no sense. If a man really feels that his foreskin is placing him at risk for any of those reasons, make that decision on his own. He has his
Yeah.
own consent process. The fact is, in Europe, where most of the men are genitally intact, the penile cancer rates are lower than they are in the US. Penile cancer is related to lack of hygiene, smoking,
Okay.
other hygiene practices. Years ago, even the American Cancer Society came out on this issue and said penile circumcision is so rare that it does not justify newborn circumcision.
Penile cancer is so rare that it doesn't justify newborn circumcision. Yeah, I mean, it's akin to, well, breast cancer is rampant. I mean, why aren't we removing the breast buds of little girls? And, you know, if right, like I don't see how this issue is any different. And we know breast cancer is a real risk. I mean, there's women younger and younger every day, even in their teens. So, but you know, we're not
Exactly.
removing the breast buds of little girls.
Well, exactly. And bring it again back to males. Male breast cancer is far more common than penile cancer.
Oh,
Yet we're
wow.
not advocating preventive mastectomies for men
Right.
or women.
Interesting. Right.
It's
Well,
because it's a cultural custom, and we look for this unending
yeah.
search for a reason to justify what we've always been doing for the past 150 years.
Right. And I think some of that, you know, in the medical profession, I think in your documentary, which I know what that was 1995. Whose body, whose rights? Okay. So, you know, we've had what almost 30 years on that now, but I'm curious if you're aware in the documentary, I think there was a doctor who said they didn't get any education on the foreskin other than like it's a piece of skin that covers the glands of the penis, and that's the part that's removed during circumcision. Like that's the sum total of education that they got.
It is. There was a
Yeah.
gentleman in the 90s who did a survey of medical textbooks. And by the way, the two doctors in the documentary, Whose Body, Whose Rights, which by the way aired on PBS stations across the country, and it's now in the American Archive of Public Broadcasting, Dr. Dean Adel, a very famous radio and TV medical doctor, said he went to Cornell University. They were taught nothing about the foreskin. Another young doctor, young at the time when he was in the movie, went to Stanford University, and he said the same thing. It's the skin that covers the head of the penis, and it's what's cut off during circumcision. Boom, that's it. Nothing about anatomy and functions.
Wow.
And so if doctors don't know this information, how can they adequately convey this information to parents? And in most cases, they're not, because when you look at consent forms for newborn circumcision, which are a form of solicitation in hospitals, oh, you've got a baby girl, wonderful, welcome to the world. Oh, you've got a baby boy, here's a consent form for circumcision. It's solicitation of a medically unnecessary surgery. My colleague Matt Goodwin and I are getting ready to publish a manuscript in a journal about a review of 50 different hospitals in the Northeast region of the US and their consent forms.
Oh, wow.
No mention that the foreskin has any functions, very little information about the risks. Also, and I don't want to get too far off on this tangent, but there in many hospital consent forms, there's a box that you tick. You do not get to opt out of it, to allow them to use the tissue.
Oh, yeah.
Basically selling the tissue to biotissue companies who then will use that to create cosmetic products, artificial skin products, and
Yeah.
so on and so forth, including Oprah Winfrey's famous face cream that a lot of Hollywood stars use
Yeah.
because it contains the neonatal fibroblasts from the foreskin. So there's a whole bunch of what I call scandal
Sure.
around this issue.
Yeah, I mean, there's so much in this. So, do you know today, you know, it's been a minute since that documentary was made. That was 95. We're in 2024 now. I mean, is that still the case in medical school where doctors are not getting any real education on the foreskin and their training?
It's changed very little based on what I know. And that's because it's the standard of care in the U.S. when you have a baby born. What incentive do they have to teach doctors about the anatomy and functions of the foreskin when they're going to be making money from cutting it off and then also selling it to biotissue companies? It just is unbelievable the amount of ignorance in the medical community about this. And then there's resistance when you do present them with new information outside of medical school. Although I never learned that in medical school. And it's like, well, get with the program. You know, European doctors, most of those doctors are intact. They have foreskins. If they're women, their partners, if they're heterosexual, have foreskins. They understand the values and the functions of the foreskin. And they consider it unethical to be subjecting a child to medically unnecessary surgery. And in many cases, they will refuse to do it.
Well, another statement that I thought was so interesting from your documentary is the statement that circumcision is a women's movement, a mother's movement. Men haven't really spoken out about this. And I think that really struck me, and I wrote that down. I want to talk about that today because I think that I think it's an interesting thing that a lot of people wouldn't assume. And I know myself being an advocate for this cause, I actually was even attacked on social media for speaking out about, you know, male infant circumcision and some of, you know, the research you're doing and the conversation we're having today. Someone said, why don't you focus on female genital mutilation in Africa? Like, why are you worried about little boys in America when women are over there in Africa getting circumcised? So there's really this strange idea that as women, we shouldn't or couldn't, or why would we be interested in being advocates for stopping this cause? And it's really good to know I'm not alone, that, you know, that this is described as a women's movement. Obviously, I think there's a lot more male voices and more men speaking out and hopefully more forums for support for these men. But talk to me about that. In what way is this a women's movement, a mother's movement?
Sure. Some of the first voices in this movement were women. And to quote Marilyn Milos, she was a nurse who had three of her sons circumcised before she became a nurse. She went to medical school. She was asked to assist with an infant circumcision. The baby was strapped to the circumstraint board and screaming. And the doctor looked into her eyes and told her there's no medical reason for this. And so what she has said in the past is before a man knows he has a penis to protect, a mother knows she has a baby to protect. This practice goes against every maternal instinct that a woman has to protect her child from harm. Now, in terms of, well, we should be looking at Africa where female circumcision is going on. There's that phrase, think globally, act locally.
Yes.
And in fact, there are many circumcised women in Africa and here at home who are rising up, including Fuambai Amadou, defending the practice if it's freely chosen by the women when they're old enough, and pointing the finger at feminists here for sticking their nose into Africa's business and condemning female circumcision when there's this double standard of what we are doing to baby boys here at home. And by the way, I want to make this very important point that most people don't recognize is wherever female circumcision never exists in isolation. There's virtually no place on the planet where they just circumcise the girls. When you look at female circumcision throughout Africa and the Middle East, their brothers are also getting circumcised at the same age. So in a perverse sense, there's more gender equality there than we have here, where we prohibit it for females and permit it for males. And I think this idea of trying to discount male circumcision by saying, oh, we need to pay attention to female circumcision is an avoidance technique. Like, oh, I don't want to think about what we're doing to boys. So why don't you turn your attention to what's being done to girls? And again, going back to what I said, in this country, 99.99% of girls are not at risk of genital cutting. It's not part of our culture, but we have laws against it. We're afraid to look at our own custom and create laws to protect the boys.
And it's interesting too. I think you said at the outset of our conversation, it's only about half of the states that have laws against female cutting. Only half. Everyone, did y'all hear that? We all think it's like outlawed in the United States. Well, apparently not, if some of the states still have that as being permitted.
Susan, can I just make a real brief point about that too? That we don't necessarily need laws, special laws against female or male, because technically, under every state law, an intervention of this type without medical necessity constitutes sexual assault. So existing laws, if we were willing to enforce them, could basically point the finger to this being done against girls or boys and saying, look, this is assault. There's no medical reason for doing this.
Well, and you're right. Assault laws are in every state, and even the equal protection, which I think is a big part of your legal angle, correct? Like coming into the courts under the equal protection under the law, which I don't know. I guess you're looking under state law, but we have 14th Amendment equal protection as well. I mean, so it exists in our Constitution, the United States Constitution, as well as in certain state constitutions. But can you talk about that for a minute from the legal
Sure,
standpoint of equal
sure.
protection?
A couple years ago, just out of the blue, I sent an email to Professor Lawrence Tribe, who's a constitutional law professor at Harvard University. He's been very involved in gay rights cases over the years. And as a gay man myself, I am aware of what he's been able to do for equality in treating Americans equally, regardless of sexual orientation. So I sent him an email. Out of the blue, he answered the very next day, "Hey Tim," like he knew me. And I had asked him, I said, "You know, here's my history with gay rights activism. I appreciate what you've done. I'm now working on this issue of genital cutting of boys. And what is your opinion if we were to try to mount a challenge to the federal statute based on equal protection, the 14th Amendment?" He wrote back and he says, "Yes, the federal statute, in his view, is unconstitutional and unsustainable just on that alone, the lack of gender protection equally." He says, "But as a strategy, don't start at the top." And he reminded me that any change in our culture has always started at the local and state level. And you get these decisions made, and then you work yourself up to the Supreme Court eventually. So our strategy with Delta is to support lawyers who want to bring cases on a state-by-state basis.
That totally makes sense. So you're going with the state constitutions that have that clause, which I would imagine quite a few of them do. What's been your research on that?
Well, almost every state has either a constitutional amendment or a statute guaranteeing equal protection of all of its citizens in the state. So that would be a fairly good argument for saying, look, we're treating boys and girls differently. And even the federal judge who looked at the federal statute a couple years ago, because it was a case of a Muslim doctor, she was being prosecuted for female circumcision in Michigan. He looked at the law and he ruled it unconstitutional initially because he says this is the state's issue. But then the Congress stepped in and revised the law to add a new state commerce clause, which then put it back into the purview of the feds. But he also made a statement. He says, as laudable as it is to offer protection against for girls, it does nothing to advance non-discrimination for the rest of children. I'm paraphrasing. So he recognized the unconstitutionality of the federal statute based on sex and gender.
Do you find, I know as I've been kind of interested in this issue and exploring and meeting others like yourself, it strikes me that there do seem to be a larger number of gay males who are impacted by their infant circumcision versus heterosexual.
Yeah, there's a study or two out there about the impact of circumcision and on gay and bisexual men. It stands to reason. Men who have sex with men are going to have more encounters with both circumcised partners and intact partners.
Yeah.
And if you were circumcised and you're bothered by it, and you have sex with another man who is circumcised, that just reminds you of what was done to you. You're going to see the scar on his penis. You're going to see how differently his penis functions from an intact penis. Also, if you happen to have sex with an intact man, you're going to be reminded about what was done to you. You're going to note how differently he reacts to subtle sensations and the functioning of the penis compared to your own penis. So gay men are in a very unique position to be evaluating the differences here in
Sure.
terms their sexual partners are. It just makes perfect sense.
Yeah. Yeah, it does, because you're interacting with penises on a regular basis, whereas a heterosexual man might be wouldn't be really, right? It's very
Yeah, he
different.
doesn't have those opportunities because it's not part of his nature. And the same for heterosexual women. Of course, heterosexual women can have a lot of partners, but probably not as many as most gay and bisexual men would have. But even then, a lot of heterosexual women have remarked about how different it is, how better it is to have sex with an intact partner because there's more you can do with an intact penis.
Yeah, I mean, I will attest to that. I would say it's definitely a different, it's different. There is something, the quality is just different. There's a gentle, something very gentle about an intact penis. It's hard kind of to put words on it, but that has definitely been my experience. And it sex is actually different. And I think as a, as a woman who mostly has sex with men, I think that that's also a part of why I did become so passionate about this topic, because I work with a lot of women who maybe have sexual pain during sex, or they a lot of that heavy thrusting that has to happen usually for a circumcised penis, right? Typically, you need more stimulation on a circumcised penis than you would on an intact penis, because you don't have that glide happening that you would if the foreskin were there. So an intact man doesn't really need to have as much thrusting and in and out motion as a circumcised penis needs. And that kind of motion on a woman's body actually can cause her to actually withdraw from sex and actually start to shut down. It can actually cause almost like a hardening of her own, the sensitivity of her vagina and her cervix. And especially there's a whole other thing that goes with that, but sex is very different. And I think that it would be a different world actually if we stopped this practice of circumcision and let penises just be natural. I think it would literally change the nature of how we have sex. And I think more women would actually find more enjoyment, because there wouldn't be all that thrusting and all that friction that's necessary wouldn't really need to be happening. And so it could be slower, it could be more sensitive. There could be so much different types of sensations available to both partners. So I know for me, that's really why I got interested in this topic, and I'll attest to that. It's a different experience.
I'll trust you on that.
Yeah, you can trust me on that one. And see out there, like, I also want to say that, all we have to look at all penises as beautiful, like even the circumcised ones. Like, I don't want to be on a soapbox here, to make any man feel like there's something wrong with him because he's circumcised.
Right. We don't want a
Right?
body shame.
But you
We
don't want
don't
a
want a
body
body shame.
shame. And what is what is, and you have to work with what is. And so, I just want to, that's my little disclaimer there that, but it is a different experience. It does feel different. And I know I have had female clients report that as when they have a new partner, oh, he's not the first uncircumcised man I've been with. And it's just different. I don't know how to describe it. There's a different sensation, and sex actually can be a different experience when you're with an intact penis. So that's my testimony.
Good, good.
Let's talk about the risks. Like, so a lot of people might say, well, there's no, circumcision is harmless. Nobody's injured by that. Or if they are, it's so few and far between. is so rare, but I don't know if that's necessarily true. Could we talk a little bit about what the risks of circumcision are, and maybe even if you have any statistics on that, how prevalent some of these things are?
Sure. One of the most common adverse consequences is something called meatal stenosis. The foreskin is there to protect the head of the penis, especially in infancy, where the foreskin is adhered to the head of the penis. You can't retract it. It's not meant to be retracted in infancy. That's a slow process. It happens as the child matures. But when you remove the foreskin, forcibly remove the foreskin from the head of the penis and then cut it off, you're left with this, I'll get graphic here, it's bloody mucosal tissue on the head of the penis. Then you're bandaging that up, you're putting it in a diaper where there's going to be urine and feces and abrasion from the diaper, and then as the child matures, there's going to be abrasion from clothing. The meatus, the urinary opening, can become irritated and it can stenose, which means it narrows, sometimes to the point of completely closing up. And in those cases, boys have to have a meatotomy to reopen the meatus. But that occurs in about 20% of infant males.
Wow.
And that's one issue. The other issue is, depending on the doctor. See, there's no, we're not born with a dotted line on the penis that says a cut here. So it depends on the doctor where he or she intends to cut. And many men in my surveys and others have reported tight, painful erections. You don't know on an organ that small as a baby how large that penis is going to grow to be by
Right.
maturity. So if you're cutting off half of the skin system, chances are it's going to be a tight, painful erection. Sometimes the scar breaks open and bleeds. The other thing is the scar. One thing that I learned from Connie Lightfoot Klein, she wrote the book on female circumcision called Prisoners of Ritual. She made a statement about female circumcision, which is equally true about male circumcision. How the scar heals will determine your response in sexuality. Scars can become numb. They can become hypersensitive, or they can develop neuromas, which are entrapped nerves, and the scar itself can be a point of discomfort. Also, the head of the penis, because it's mucosal tissue, when you remove the foreskin, the body reacts to that by doing something called keratinization, which is growing extra layers of skin to protect that. It's the common word we use is callousing. But keratinization then adds further layers of skin, which further dulls the sensation of the head of the penis. Plus, infant circumcision removes a specialized piece of tissue on the underside of the head called the frenulum, which is like what we have under the tongue or other parts of the body. And that's the most densely innervated part of the foreskin itself.
Oh, wow.
Well, that's almost always ablated 100% in infant circumcision. Adult circumcision can preserve that tissue, but not infant. So there's a whole range of just physical sexual complications, not even to mention the emotional and psychological stuff later on.
Well, so we are getting near the end of our time, but there's a couple more things I want to touch on before we wrap up. And I think this is a nice segue into this idea of restoration. So you were the co-founder of the National Organization of Restoring Men, or NORM as it's known. And I just think this is fascinating. And I think we need to talk about this idea of foreskin restoration. What on earth is this, and how is it done? And what are some of the benefits from the men that have done this? And can you speak to that a little bit for our listeners?
Sure. Actually, foreskin restoration has a long history. This is not some new fad. The first recorded instances of foreskin restoration were among Jews of the Hellenic era, where their original foreskin was not as, or original circumcision was not as radical as it is today. And in Greek culture, it was considered rude to have the exposed head of the penis. They There was nudity in the bathhouses where business was conducted, the Olympic Games, and so on and so forth. So in order to conform to society, some Jewish men would pull the skin forward and tie a leather thong. That would actually cause more skin to grow and eventually cover up the head of the penis. This is what modern-day foreskin restoration entails, is manual skin expansion. It's something that doctors use all the time. For example, say you were burned on this side of the face. Doctors will take a saline balloon and put it on this side of the face, slowly enlarge it with saline or air, and then harvest the skin and put it on the burn side. This is all men are doing, is growing more skin on the penis to eventually cover the head and become what I call a faux skin, F-A-U-X. It's approximate the look, function, and feel. And there's a psychological component, taking back your body from the circumciser and so forth. So,
sure. And it also, my understanding is that it'll never be the foreskin, the actual foreskin, because you don't have all the, you know, it's just a different.
You'll never get back the nerve endings. No.
You're going to get back the nerve endings, right. However, it does help with reducing that keratinization or that callusing of the head of the penis. So you get some more of that mucosal tissue that regenerates, and that can help with pleasure and sensation significantly. Is that true?
Absolutely. Men in my survey and their wives have reported how improved their sex lives were after the husband engaged with foreskin restoration.
Wow, awesome. Okay, so I'm going to give you one final statement here that I'd love you to respond to, and then I will give you a chance to share how our listeners can find out more and any other things you have coming up. So this is from your documentary, Whose Body, Whose Rights. Circumcision does more than just remove a foreskin. Circumcision removes a choice.
I think that speaks for itself. That was by one of our early members, Norm Cohen, who still is active in the movement. He runs No Circ of Michigan. And that's what it basically amounts to, that you're making a choice about someone else's body that's permanent and irreversible. And I don't care whether you're talking about male circumcision, female circumcision, intersex genital surgeries on newborns, to make them binary and conform to societal expectations, you're changing someone else's body without them having a chance to weigh in on the decision.
Yeah. Now, I know a lot of people would respond to that with this idea that, well, a baby doesn't have, the parents are the ones that get to do informed consent for the child. The baby doesn't have consent or doesn't have choice. And they'll liken it to like vaccines, for example. Like parents giving a child childhood vaccines. Well, a child doesn't consent to that. So how is this any different? How is circumcision any different? Why is this more important than something like that, for example?
Well, it's way different. Now, I know there's a lot of controversy these days about vaccines, but
yeah, we're not going to go there.
Right. Traditionally, vaccines have been accepted the world over, and they are distributed equally to boys and girls.
Okay.
They're not gender specific. And technically, vaccines add medicine to the body to help the body's immune system. Circumcision is totally different. You're cutting off a functional body part. You're subtracting something from the body. Mm-hmm. And in general, parents do have the responsibility to consent to medically necessary interventions. And again, I know vaccines has become controversial, but circumcision across the globe is debatable and controversial. There's no agreement outside of the U.S. about that. In fact, there's quite a bit of agreement that it's not medically necessary and that it's unethical and that parents do not have the choice to make medically unnecessary interventions on their children.
Well, I like how you said that. This is taking something off, removing something from the body rather than like adding something to the body. That's a really good way to say it. And I'm curious too, just sort of in wrapping up our conversation, why is it that the United States seems to be kind of the outlier here in terms of male infant circumcision? Do you think it has to do with sort of the, you know, we have the Puritan roots really of this country, sort of the religious influences where the circumcision was seen as a cure for masturbation. Of course, masturbation was just the devil and caused all kinds of ailments, according to the early Puritanistic settlers of our country. But why do you think this practice has stuck around as long as it has, and why is America or United States sort of the outlier with continuing this practice?
That's a good question, Susan. Initially, we began the practice, as did other English-speaking countries, the UK, Canada, Australia, New Zealand, because of the influence of Victorian-era thinking that masturbation was bad, and the way you stop masturbation and protect children is to remove the movable tissue that you use to masturbate with on the penis. And for the girls, it was carbolic acid on the clitoris. So this was not something we just thought of for boys. We wanted to stop girls from masturbating too. But the reason it continues to this day is money.
Money.
It's a huge industry. Doctors, hospitals, insurance companies, biotissue companies, the manufacturers of devices, they're all making money off of this culturally acceptable practice that even the AAP, the American Academy of Pediatrics, admits is a social custom.
Well, and again, I keep saying we're going to wrap up, but there's more that's coming through on it. I mean, I'm wondering, like, in terms of the legal angle, I know that there have been suits brought to sue the circumciser, sue the hospital where the person was circumcised as an infant. There might have been some other more personal injury types of claims that have been brought into the courts, but in your perspective, I'm curious if legislation around maybe making it no longer so profitable, like what you said, I think in Massachusetts, that lawsuit to get Medicaid not to pay for it, like taking away the financial incentive. I wonder if that might be an angle that would be an effective legal path or legal strategy for this cause. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, that has been tried in about a
Okay.
dozen to 15 states in the past. Children's rights advocates have been successful in getting an end to state Medicaid funding of
Okay.
circumcision. But across the board, I mean, I have letters from insurance companies from the 1990s in which our members wrote to them and said, "Hey, this is not medically necessary. Why are you covering this?"
Yeah.
And these letters in black and white say, well, from a consumer satisfaction standpoint, we still offer this service because they understand that parents still want it. Parents are the ones who pay the premiums, and they are afraid that if they stop paying for infant circumcision,
Wow.
parents will go, "You know, this insurance company wouldn't pay for this. I'm going to the other insurance
Oh,
company
man.
who does."
Wow.
And this is the same mentality that goes on with doctors, which keeps
Yeah.
doctors stopping it because they say, "Well, you know, I don't like to do it. I disagree with it. But if the parent wants it, I know I can't talk them out of it. So I'm going to do it anyway." And they make
Wow.
money rather than getting a reputation that, "Oh, you know that Dr. Smith. He wouldn't perform a circumcision, so I'm going to go to Dr.
Yeah,
Jones for that."
sure.
And then that Dr. Smith loses that, if he's a pediatrician, loses that patient for the next 18
Wow.
years, hence the income.
Wow. Well, I thought it was really notable at the end of your documentary, this team or this group of nurses who were all taking a
Yes.
stand and were refusing to perform the procedure, which kind of loops back around to this, this is issues like it's a women's movement in some way. And I'm curious your take on that. Like, what do you think is the biggest opportunity? Like, where does the grassroots change? Where is it going to be the most effective? Is it with educating the parents, educating the medical establishment, educating the nurses, going to the legal system? Like, what do you think is the biggest opportunity in terms of advocating for this cause and really moving the needle?
All of it.
All of the above.
It's
Okay.
going to take a multiplicity of approaches. Female
Yeah.
circumcision cannot just be ended by a law. You
Right.
have to have education programs. You have to have doctors mobilized. You have to have the citizens mobilized. The same thing's going to apply with male circumcision, that you have to attack it from many different angles,
Yeah.
because a little win here could influence another win over there and another win over there. And
Yeah.
there's no silver bullet, no one piece of advice that I could give. It's just going to
Okay.
take everything.
Everything. So pick the one you're passionate about and roll with that.
And go for it. Go for it.
Yeah. Oh, I love it. Well, Tim, I just want to thank you so much just for the incredible work that you've been doing over the last 30 years in this field. And it's really an inspiration. I think that you're really a way maker, a trailblazer. And, I hope that this, all the work that you've done, it has. I think it's made a huge difference. I think it has paved the way for those who will come after you and hopefully make the way a little bit easier. I know it's not easy kind of being at the forefront of a movement, but I just want to thank you so much for all that you've done and just the service that you've provided in this
Thank
arena.
you. I
Yeah,
appreciate
and
it.
you're welcome. And want to give you an opportunity right now if you'd like to share with our listeners just anything, how they can get in touch with you or learn more about GALDEF, the Legal Defense and Education Fund, and anything else you would like to share with the listeners before we wrap up.
Sure, I'd be happy to. Well, first and foremost, people can stay up to date by subscribing to our free monthly email newsletter. They go to galdef.org, GALDEF.org. And at the bottom of the homepage, they can subscribe to our newsletter. They can also stay informed about what's going on by going to the media tab. And then the first drop down under that is news. And there we have our news items about what's happening in the movement and with GALDEF. And we have two events happening right now that I would like to really promote. One is we have a GoFundMe campaign to support legal justice for circumcision sufferers. They can find that in the news tab. And then for those of you who are interested in seeing the video, Whose Body, Whose Rights, we are doing a special global screening. It's going to be in a Zoom webinar shown at the same time around the globe on Saturday, May 4th. And it's available for a ticket purchase because it is a fundraiser. And what they can do is go to galdef.org, go to media, drop down to news, and then click on the entry for the global screening of Whose Body, Whose Rights. And it'll tell them more about that, the screening times. And there's a special button that will take them to TicketStripe to buy a ticket.
Fantastic. And I know you shared the links to many of those resources you just mentioned. So I'll make sure to put those in the show notes for our listeners
Thank you.
who maybe didn't catch that on the audio. Well, great. Well, thank you so much, Tim, for being my guest here on the Sex Talk Cafe. It's been an just absolute delight having you. Thank you.
Thank you for the opportunity, Susan.
Thank you for joining me today for the Sex Talk Cafe. Please be sure to show your support by subscribing to this podcast and sharing it with your friends. To keep in the loop on future events and happenings, and to grab your copy of our free ebook, The Pleasure Keys, 7 Secrets to Feminine Sexual Fulfillment, visit us online at pathwaytopleasure.com.